Everybody, it's Katie Kessner. You're on the Dear Katie podcast. I'm so pleased to have all of you back with us. We have such a great episode for you today to learn and dig in on what exactly the hotline for sexual assault survivors getting legal justice looks like. I will introduce our special guest in just a second, but I'm pleased to have with me Emily Wang. How are you, Emily?
Hey, everyone. Hey, I'm Emily. I will be co-hosting today with Katie, and I'm so excited to have our special guest today.
Thanks, Emily. And Darcy Hall is in Rhode Island, I believe, and can tell all of us a little bit about herself, where you went to school, how you came into the practice of helping sexual assault survivors get justice.
Great. Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here with you today. I really appreciate it. And my name is Darcy Hall. I come to law a little bit circuitous route. My actual background and training is more in sales and marketing, and I actually went to school for a master's in public health. And then as that developed, there was a lot going on in the insurance industry around wellness and actually using data to impact women's lives and really trying to drill down into population health. And that was always very fascinating for me. So I ended up with a background that included selling into the Fortune 100, wellness programs and health insurance. I even got an opportunity to work with some really wonderful thought leaders around Obamacare, including former minority speaker Dick Gephardt and Alan Enthoven, who created Holland's healthcare system and Kaiser Permanente. So as that was winding down and having accomplished that in my life, I was working remotely for an organization and using actually office space here in the building. And the local attorney here asked me if I would mind being a consultant on one of their cases. They had a sexual assault case that was happening on the corporate level. And he was really having some difficulties struggling with the pressure points that he might use with a very large organization to get the emails that he needed, uncover some of the cover-up that was happening. Obviously, being a woman, it's, you know, very closed. You don't have a single friend or family member that hasn't had their own Me Too moment. So very much wanted to participate with that as well. Found myself really in love with both here in Rhode Island, the area itself. It's always the area that we would always vacation with. So when I was given an opportunity to come in, join the firm formally, very much wanted to do that. As a sidebar, I was also so impressed with the attorney that I fell in love with and married him.
So Darcy was just saying, like, let's just go back for a second to public health and all your initiatives. Was it a specific interest in women's health, women's public health?
So when I was out, I went to the University of Connecticut, and during my undergrad, I actually worked for the Women's Studies Division doing really their marketing. And so obviously you start to pick up on a lot of the different areas and what's going on campus. And so started with just doing marketing for them. And then, you know, from there went on to other corporate ventures. But the piece around women's health has always been, I think, one of the biggest areas that public health can really have such a big impact on. You look at things like mammography rates or initiatives around diabetes or infant mortality. And there are a lot of pieces that serve women. And it's a population that's largely ignored in public health. Many of the studies are focused on men and what male outcomes are for things like heart attacks. There have been a couple of studies that are specifically done on nurses, but it's not been a population that's largely been focused on. So that was always fascinating for me. You know, from a career perspective, it was more of doing things around wellness and complete populations, you know, women included, but some of those would get carved out.
Thanks for that explanation. That helps a lot. And it also gives like a depth to how you're looking at the problem of sexual violence as part of public health. We haven't spent a lot of time on the public. I'm on the podcast thinking about like when a woman is raped, she might have gotten pregnant. She might have acquired an STD, HIV, like a lot of concerns for women that relate directly to health. So that's like, maybe we can also shed some light on those concerns and how they relate to litigation. Because, you know, if a woman's raped and also has these other many extraneous situations after that, they add to the damages, basically, right? They add to what's possible in terms of an outcome.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting about those components is that when a woman gets raped, while obviously she is our main client, there are pieces in her life that are so dramatically impacted. So it impacts her relationship with her husband, her boyfriend, her ability to relate going forward. If she has children, it often disrupts, you know, many of the regular parental or maternal patterns that you might be having. If people are depressed, they're in the middle of a trauma, they are not their best selves, they're not bringing their best selves to their family, you know. And so a lot of times, in addition to the actual rape victim, our clients also include spouses and children as well. So the spouses, for instance, have a lack of consortium claim where, you know, they can no longer have their regular wife that they used to have. There is very much a distinct before and after the event that carries with them, you know, forever. You know, there may be a loss of income. If they were a primary earner in the family, they can no longer work. It may have been an event that happened in or around the work event itself. You know, maybe something was happening at an employer and they can no longer work at that job. There are pieces that we've had clients who really want to move from an area because their particular attack was public and they don't want to live that every day. They want a fresh start. So certainly there are a lot of financial pieces. Then in addition to the female component, obviously is impacting a community sometimes. We are certainly their own small community of their family and coworkers.
Thanks so much, Charcy. Let's think about how we want to go through a bunch of topics. I know we left off before I interrupted you on you met the man of your dreams through coming to your practice. So maybe we start there, but then also go into what does it look like every day at your small firm to make decisions about and how to help victims? Lee, can you think of anything else to start with?
No, I think that that's a really, really great jumping point. I did get very excited because it's very rare that we get a very nice romantic story that comes out of these interviews. I was like, wow.
And I can share with you, when, you know, I was not an attorney and coming to this process felt very foreign. And part of when I was brought into my first case, the attorney here said, I'd like you to sit in and hear the intake process. You know, I know a little about this client. I know what happened to her. She's going to have to tell the story several times. So it's good to get a female perspective on it. And I was really brought in to get this corporate perspective on it. And I think that part of the pieces, there were several things that really kind of surprised me. I think that for my own self, when I think about sexual assault, I immediately think about the criminal process. And that, you would call the police and you would go and get a rape kit done and you would be sucked into this, you know, very criminal process where I would both be protected if I were a woman and that justice would be served. And unfortunately, that does not happen a lot of the time. And some of that is just because of circumstances, right? You could be a woman who you're raped on a business trip or something and you choose to shower and not say anything for several days until you are someplace safe and you've got your support network back with you. Or you could be on a college campus and you kind of get swept into that whole process. The institutional pieces around this, I think, are interesting. Like when you end up going to the hospital and there is sort of a wave that takes you as you're going through this process. The interesting thing for me is that I think that it is important that women stop. Do what you can in that moment, but understand that you will be able to control it. You can stop it. You can say, I don't want to pursue a suit. But it is important to maybe do the rape kit or ask the question.
Let's talk about let's go back just two sentences, Darcy. I wanted to start with, you know, when people call the hotline, they might have in their vision or mindset, kind of where you started was the criminal justice. Like, I want this person to stop hurting me and put them in prison. I want, they're not sure exactly. They just want this to end and they want someone to possibly just say, I was wrong. I'm sorry. And I'll pay for my damage. There's a million types of narratives that go through a survivor's call when they contact the hotline or try and seek justice. And then you were saying, but there's a ton of reasons why they might not get what they want. So I want to sit with our listeners and say, like, yes, absolutely. You can each have a vision of what seems fair and correct. And it might not even feel like it will remedy what happened, but you have a vision of what you dream could happen if you call a hotline or put in a form or reach out to the police, call the police. It might be out of desperation, but there's this initial vision. And Darcy was saying, like, unfortunately, and you went into like medical, like, did you capture the medical evidence? Like a million things that might go wrong along that way. But what I also hear you saying, Darcy, is just the process of reaching out might be helpful in and of itself, especially when they reach out to a firm like yours, because you're going to sit with where they are. Can you talk about that?
So when somebody comes in, I think, and these are questions I think you should be asking if you are kind of shopping for a law firm or considering taking a next step, I think it's important to ask the question, but you want to kind of sit with yourself a little bit and say, what do I really want out of this process? And, you know, what am I hopeful for? And then as you approach a law firm, there are some things that I recommend people doing and things that we do to help keep our clients safe. So for instance, when somebody comes to Hall Law, they are met with a team. There's always a female in the room. They are not just meeting with an attorney.
When they meet with you in person.
Correct.
Before we get to in person, let's do what happens if they just call or email your firm.
They call, they will either speak with myself or they would speak with the main attorney. And everyone here has done this for a very long time. We often recognize that we may be the first time that somebody is able to share their story. Those are not quick phone calls. We like to give people the space that they need in order to tell the whole story. You know, we will stop and ask some clarifying questions. But very often we want to start to build a relationship with them. And there's this piece around validating what happened to them. Obviously, sometimes there's been quite a bit of time from their actual attack. Like, for instance, we've had children survivors, people who have been sexually assaulted by priests or coaches or teachers or family members, you know, trusted people in their lives. And as they're going through, for instance, their own therapy process, it may be time for them to say, I would like to do more with this, and I would like to find out what my options are. And so our very first meetings are really around that and trying to help women figure out what they want to do next and what their options might be. And, you know, when they come in, it's usually the two of us, you know, both the attorney, James Hall, and myself, and we have staff here as well. We also have Lunar the therapy dog, which...
Oh, that sounds great. Tell us about Lunar, the therapy dog. That sounds immediately awesome.
She's a diminutive golden. She is there on our website. She is admittedly far more popular than anyone else here at the office. We always check with clients to say, you know, are you a dog person? And she started doing this thing where we would have clients come in, and as they were telling their story, she will go over and either put her head on their knee or she will put a paw on their leg. And I've watched her. She will hold hands with our clients for 2 to 3 hours, you know, while they're there and talking. It's the cutest thing, it really is. And it seems to bring people a great amount of comfort. We encourage people to bring their own support person with them. You know, they'll often come with like a mom or their husbands or a trusted friend. You know, it's not something that you have to do alone. You know, there is tea and tissues and whatever you need to get yourself comfortable. Can stop at any time. This is not something that you're forced to do. If you, you know, find that you're too uncomfortable having that conversation, you know, you can take a break. We can stop and reschedule. It's not something you have to do at all. And we try to be very transparent with people to make sure that they know what to expect every step of the process. You know, we run through, you know, practice calls or practice conversations with them in terms of having to go to more formal pieces of a legal process, like a deposition. You always have, you know, somebody there.
You're using more it's a deposition. Let's back up. Now you went in for a while. Maybe Emily, maybe you could think, what else do you want to go back to? Darcy was talking about a ton of stuff. I left off at like her amazing dog, therapy dog. Maybe we like kind of go back a little bit, Darcy, because you're like so on top of it. Emily, what caught your attention from what Darcy was saying?
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of thinking a little bit about like how terrifying and how like foreign the process kind of seems as someone who's never ever gone through it. And so I'm curious as to like whether you guys have any methods to sort of encourage people to even reach out and make this process seem a little bit like less scary than I think a lot of us are made to believe. Yeah, especially like as someone who's like never been inside a courtroom, never been arrested, like terrified of even the police. So like how is that process like made a little bit more approachable?
So I think one of the things that we like to share with our clients on our first call is that the process does not even necessarily include a trial. A lot of times people can come in, start to build their case or hear if they even have a case. And again, I think it goes back to being fully transparent with them to say, you control this process. It is completely up to you of what your level of tolerance is to move forward. You are really right now just asking the question. It is not in a courtroom. We've actually created a culture where it is fairly casual and laid back here. And people are not necessarily wearing suits that day. And it is not a big, scary conference room. You know, you're going to come in and have a conversation with us, you know, and see where you want to take this process. And if you even want to move forward from there. And I think that's really comforting for a lot of people that it is not something that it's not a train that you're getting on and you can't get off of. If at any point you want to stop, you can just stop. And that to me was a big deal. Like when I first heard a few conversations that we would have, it's like, you know, I think you should come in and have a conversation to learn and get educated about your options. And it tends to be pretty detailed in terms of, you know, what happened to you? How would these elements of what happened to you be proven? And what would that dialogue look like? You know, we've had cases where it has been family members, and we encourage people to make sure that you are in conjunction with your conversation with us using therapists, because you are going to need support.
The idea of having a therapist and what resources are reasonable for you to help a survivor acquire or know about. Do you feel like your firm does that well? Like we try to connect people with resources that will help them along the way?
Absolutely. So, you know, sadly, having done this for a number of years, you figure out that there are practitioners, some of whom are better than others. And I would say the therapy piece for us falls into two categories. You know, one is someone who is truly trauma focused and going to help our client heal. And we really try and act as a bridge between what happened to them and a nice, healthy place that they can get to. And we understand that we might just be a single tool of theirs that they're using. The other piece is to do something along the lines with a forensic psychiatrist. And this is someone who is more legally based and are looking for elements in your life that kind of point back to proof points of that trauma. So for instance, if we're looking at somebody who has been traumatized, you know, as a child, these folks are experts in being able to work with them to talk about how some of those things might portray as evidence in their adult lives. And you'll see some common patterns where, you know, people may have trouble with male adult authority figures, or they may have trouble attaining dental care. They may have problems with existing family members, not being able to sustain a relationship. They might be hypersexualized their whole life or not be sexual at all their whole life. And so they're looking for pieces in their story that can speak to something that happened a long time ago, or might just be interesting proof points of what happened to them as kind of the fallout of that and help them cure.
Can you give us some like case studies so our listeners can kind of relate to someone who you've helped? You know, you don't have to name names, obviously, but I think a narrative that's relatable and understandable might like help our listeners understand what that looks like.
Yeah, as I'm talking about this, it's kind of an amalgamation of a couple of clients. Again, you know, obviously client privacy is extremely important to us as part of their being able to control the process. One of the things that we do, for instance, for our people is we actually file under a Jane Doe status. So they won't necessarily ever have to have their name attached to anything if they choose not to do so. So in that vein, you know, we tend to represent I would say clients kind of fall into three or four different categories. One would be somebody who is a childhood survivor. They've either been molested by, for a while, really, it was a lot. There was a lot of priest pieces. There was a lot of childhood survivors as some of those statutes of limitations have changed. So if you are someone who has been molested and you are under the age of 18, you've got a full 35 years here in Rhode Island in order to bring suit. And as those people going into adulthood and kind of feeling their own empowerment, they've been approaching us. So if I look at, for instance, there's a client that comes to mind. She came to us at the age of 30, and she had a parent who was extremely abusive and had basically 4 to 7 years before her mom finally figured out what's going on and got her out of the influence of her direct family member. That piece was very interesting to me because there was a lot of blocked memories for her. She was working with a therapist and starting to remember some of the things that were happening to her in detail. There was never a doubt that this happened because adults had intervened and had, you know, caught some of these bad acts in progress. The police were involved with that, the father was in jail at the time, but he also had assets. And she now found herself as a 30-year-old, really struggling with adulthood and, could not sustain a relationship, had problem getting medical care, basic things around her autonomy as a woman. And as we proceeded through that suit, she was able to gain some significant funds. It included having her father having to sell off some property that he owned. And to me, that was very significant. And I think that is one of the pieces that was surprising to me. When you come to a law firm and you're bringing a civil case, I almost think it's better for victims than going through the criminal process.
Why?
Because that person has assets themselves. You're taking something that is meaningful to that bad actor, right? I mean, like in this case, we took that person's property. We were able to, we've had cases where we've had physicians or we have taken their medical license, as a result of our investigation and the suit. And while money can never truly bring people back to a whole place, it certainly can be powerful in rebuilding your life. If you want to move from the area, in this young lady's case, she went back to school and was able to get a degree off of this money. And it's very powerful to me to watch the amazing things that our clients do going forward. You know, it's not just about the win for me. It's wonderful when you get to hear about, you get to watch people heal over time and watch their dreams. And what they want to do is they pick up and move forward from these horrible events. And sometimes the money really helps. It helps them get therapy that they need. It helps them get stable housing. It may help them, physically move from an area. It costs victims so much in so many different ways. And to have this one piece, at least be able to fill up their bucket a little more.
I love that, Darcy. Like, let our listeners think about that for a second. I like two things you said. One is the criminal might not be as satisfying as the civil, because we're taking away things that mean a lot to them, including like property or childhood memories. Like, I want to sit with that. And then next is, like, it sounds like your firm is really patient in helping the survivor do that process. I want to ask this question. How often do you run up against, like, I can't possibly be worth that? My harm, there's guilt, residual blame. I should not be entitled to all of that, even though you're trying to quantify the damage in every way possible. I can only imagine that the emotional might overshadow the analytical money analysis that you're trying to help a survivor understand. Like, you are worth that. How do you get there with them?
I think that as they go through the process with us, we're asking them some quantifiable questions, right? So it's not, you cannot put a number on what happened to them. So instead, you try and start putting a number on how you dealt with this. Did you miss time for work? Were there physical injuries that got to you? What relationships did this blow up for you? How have you been coping? And some of those have quantifiable numbers. You know, so certainly if you're missing time from work, you had to drop out of school and not obtain your degree. you lost a semester's worth of tuition or lost opportunity in terms of when you were going to graduate, and now you've been derailed for 2 years and are trying to build back. Those have quantifiable numbers. And I think that people start to put a dollar amount on those things.
Darcy, you're doing so great. But I'm thinking about our listeners. So many have such trepidation, such fear factor, like, I'm still not worth that. I don't think I deserve that. Is there a way that you found in your practice that someone's like, oh, I am willing to be that strong? You know, I am willing to be that visionary and certain that I deserve that. Is there like a tipping point?
What happens is women will come to us, they arrive kind of broken. And part of it is hearing this validation that this should never have happened. And especially when you have the added layer of some of these institutional pieces, like where it happened at a college and the college is somewhat responsible because they hired a person without an appropriate background check, or they were leaving doors open or knew that this person had had a previous history. Like, as those items become available for our clients and they learn about what happened to them, we had one recently that was in a hospital setting, and it was a patient had assaulted another patient. And that one to me was so infuriating because the institution itself was responsible for both those individuals and keeping both of them safe. And so here, this person who was at the most vulnerable part of their life, you know, they were already at an institution, they were already out of hospital because they had something going on. And it had really very little to do with them. They got angry at the hospital for letting this happen to them. And the other part was, victims want to make sure it doesn't happen to other people, is the other part. So while they may not be willing to fight that fight for themselves, they are often willing to stand and be the voice of the people who are coming up next to them. I don't want this to happen to other students. I don't want this to happen to other patients. How do I step in? And maybe I can be a voice for them. There is absolutely a righteousness in this fight.
I think I want to like touch back on the concept of like being afraid, because again, the legal process is just so foreign to a lot of people. And I think for me in particular, like if I thought about like, oh, I think I'm willing to speak my truth in a lot of public settings, but I think that we're all very much afraid of like being questioned in a courtroom. Like, are you sure this wasn't your fault? Actually, maybe like you did everything wrong and that's why this happened. And so in like your experience, how extreme does that line of questioning usually go? Ooh, is that something,
you know? Emily, I love that question.
This was something that was, again, not being an attorney and coming to this, it was a surprise for me. But on the one hand, I think that the civil side is far quieter. There is typically not a jury, and often these things will settle in advance of that. What you want to do from an attorney perspective is that you are putting out all the proof points. You're building the case so you can have some conversations so that, you know, hopefully it doesn't even go to a trial. The idea is that the other side would step up and do the right thing. And while they largely don't do that voluntarily, by the time you are able to lay out a case of the things that you can prove, now they're willing to come to the table and talk. So again, we kind of talk about the process of this. Somebody comes in, they tell us their truth. We talk to them about what it might look like. The very next step is putting all of this on paper and then gathering things like medical records. Like, how do we prove what happened to you? If you were traveling on business, can we look at some of those travel records? If somebody has left you threatening texts, can we look at those? What do we have in terms of evidence? And so it's not always going to go all the way to a trial. And there are times within the process that we stop and we ask our clients, do you want to move forward or do you want to stop? And because they're able to control it, that really helps. The line of questioning on the extreme part, this part does make me uncomfortable. And it is some of the pieces that we are very candid with our client about. The other side will have an attorney. If we are saying that you have been damaged by this event and your life is shattered, being able to illustrate that makes sense, right? There's a before and an after. And as much as we get to present our proof on before and after, they get to present it too.
Okay, I have a question, Darcy. Remember in this past 12 months, I believe it was Gwyneth Paltrow. This is personal injury, right? And so the man who sued her on the ski slope for the, like, they went down the hill and she or he, they crashed, I think she crashed into him. And he sued her for tons of money. And some of the things we're you just said, like, how do we prove what the impact was, right? How do we sit with, like, yep, I suffered all these things. And the man had said, like, I've suffered all these things. And then they found his social media where he was off partying and having a great time while he was claiming all this, like, horrible stuff. I think maybe a victim might even be fearful, like, oh my gosh, if I'm going to be able to prove this much damage, am I even allowed to have fun in my life? What if someone captures me with a smile? Like, am I going to lose my case? Like, that's where my head went just briefly when you said that. Oh my God, I can't be under a microscope. Will they hire like a private investigator, a PI to like follow me around and disprove that I'm really harmed? That's a valid concern, I think.
We caution people around, you know, be careful about what you're posting online. There's your public and your private stuff. And you get to be both of those people. But I mean, I do this even with my own children, where it's, you know, be cautious of what you put out there about yourself, because you are being judged for that. And so there are, I think we also lean into a lot of our psychologists around that.
Like, do they help when you say you lean into them? Do you help the survivor, like, learn what is a do and a don't?
Yeah. So when people come in, you know, part of the transparency and letting them know what to expect. If you are claiming emotional damages from a rape, they get to ask you questions about, you know, well, what was your dating life before? You know, it's not up in a court. It is typically happens in a deposition, which is, you know, largely a conference room with their attorney and you, and they get to ask you those questions.
Do you get to have a support person in the deposition?
So you can bring the support person. We often tell people to actually schedule whoever their therapist is, to schedule that immediately after, because it just, they're going to take you down paths that you don't necessarily want to go. You're going to be asked to describe the event again. And you know, they may ask you things about your social life, or, you know, prove to me that this has impacted your career some way, or, you know, maybe your grades weren't good and you were going to drop out of school anyway. I mean, those things definitely come into the conversation. We like to uncover all of them in advance of that, so there aren't any surprises for the person. We can, you know, largely tell them what they're going to ask. But when you are asking them to try and decipher what the damages are like, you know, they do get to ask questions about your life, because you are trying to portray what my life was before versus what my life is after. You know, and we find that our folks do a really good job with it. You know, it's, you know, am I dating? Not really. Or, you know, we've had people who are, I'm dating like crazy. I just want to get that memory out of my head. And yep, I am, you know, I went off the rails for a couple of years before I started therapy. Or, you know, people have their own personal experience that they get to bring to it. It doesn't make it right or wrong. It is just your own personal journey of healing.
Yeah. Emily, do you have another question for Darcy?
Yeah, I'm thinking a little bit about, like, social media and like the use of social, because I think a lot of this is what I notice with like some of my friends who are on the older side, is that they're not very careful about the things that they say online because they haven't ever had an experience where like that's been used against them. And so in your experience, like has anyone had like something that they've said online be sort of brought to the table as like evidence that like, oh, you're actually fine, or like you were dealing with these same problems before? Like, is that something that you've seen before?
I think that, you know, the social media piece is important. You know, for instance, when something happens to somebody, there are, you know, you can get raped on campus and suddenly it could actually become sensationalized and end up, you know, on campus pieces, and it's going viral kind of thing. So depending on what happened to you, you know, whether or not you choose to make that public, you know, you need to recognize that everything that you put into a text or anything that you put into social media, those things are subpoenable. So if you put, you know, you're writing text to this person and you guys are going back and forth and you're angry and you're saying things, that those texts work both ways, you know, where you actually can get copies of those. And I don't know, to your point, that even like, you know, older friends or even younger friends, like, I don't know that I thought the texts were necessarily something that were not private or that you couldn't get to. But I think it's important to be conscious of those things for all of us. You know, it's like, you really shouldn't be saying anything on Facebook that you wouldn't feel otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, in a most basic sense, for instance, we've had cases where, you know, I think just a basic personal injury case where somebody's like, oh, my back is hurt so badly. And then you see somebody, you know, holding their 100-pound dog in a
gotcha,
you know, a month later or a week later. And you know, certainly, you know, there is a truth to that too. It's like, you know, if something has happened, you probably are behaving in a particular fashion. And people can say things out of anger, but you do need to be cautious about what you're putting out there online, you know, even as you're in the middle of the process, because those can come back.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that that's something I've talked to some of my friends who have gone through like Title IX trials and like the concerns around like, oh, what can you say? What can't you say? Like how to be very, very cautious about how you act moving forward, just because people will and can bring almost anything to light and it can be really unexpected. And of course, like incredibly triggering, which is why, of course, therapy is so important. I'm curious as to like, do you coach or do you like tell your clients what to expect or like how to be a little bit more careful about, you know, the things that they're sharing or the things that might be asked? What exactly, what information do they receive about that?
Yeah. So when somebody comes in, and again, we kind of get back to this transparency thing, because we are a smaller firm, we really want to partner with these people. Like we have a true relationship with them, you know, where it's not just, oh, you're another case. And most of these take upwards of a year. We are meeting with them very frequently. We give out cell phone numbers because it's our belief that, you know, you should not be anxious about something at 10 o'clock at night. If you have thoughts remunerating and you were worried about something, please text us and one of us will get back to you. We are as much part of your support network as, you know, other members of family or your psychiatrist. We are another tool in your toolkit for you to be able to heal. And, but part of that is, you know, we try and guide you on this process to say, you know, what will you expect? Here are some questions that we think that they're going to ask of you. You know, when we look through your medical records, we notice you have a history with drugs. We need to have a conversation about that because they're going to ask you. And you may have very good reasons for it. Like, yes, I was self-medicating to get myself through the day because I was so miserable. But we don't want people to be surprised by those things. So when you look through someone's social media history, you know, immediately following a rape, you know, it may be very different and not reflective of them as a person as much as it is reaction to the event. But we do tell people like, you know, hey, going forward, these are some things that, you know, you may want to be conscious of. You know, what you put out there is public and, you know, be careful about what you post. And, you know, because those things can be used in an unflattering way. Yeah, we try and keep the process as safe for people as we can. I do think that the civil side is far more private than a typical criminal side. You know, when I look at what has happened to our clients when they've gone through the criminal process, you know, when you go to a police station, a lot of time it's male dominated. They may have, you know, one or two female officers, but there is that whole male component in a uniform. It can be very scary. For most of our cases, we seem to be hitting people later in that process, right? So they've already either gone through that, or this is, you know, 6 months or a year later, you know, they're coming to us, you know, far after the event. I mean, that window seems to be narrowing a little bit, but as people learn that there is a civil option for them, that they can pursue things on this side as well as just the traditional criminal side. You can get your own attorney who can be your voice, can be your shield, and, you know, help uncover what happened to you. And especially for people who I think are in, you know, some kind of institutional setting, that can be really powerful because you realize that it was certainly nothing you did. You know, it's definitely about the, you know, bad guy who did this. And I say guy because typically it is. We do have a fair amount of people who are males who've been raped, but almost exclusively the people who are the bad agents are typically male. But one of the things that, makes us unique in this space is we actually have custody of a 55-year-old male with Down syndrome. It is James's brother, but we with the disabled.
We missed your... Hold that thought for 1 second, because we definitely want to hear about that. That will end the podcast like on this happy, like everything is possible note. But Emily, before we leave Darcy and her brilliant law narrative of how we can help survivors find justice in lots of ways, any closing thoughts, questions? Darcy clearly is happy to tell us the real deal.
Yeah, I guess like as a final concluding thought on the law side, what can people expect regarding like verdicts and how things like kind of play out afterwards? Because I think that like we've discussed a lot about the before, the during, like what to expect, but what happens like after?
And I'm going to interrupt. Emily's like, where's the money? Show me the money. Like, not to quote an actor, but it's like, show me the money and what does it feel like? I think two things are important. Like, what does the resolution look like, really and truly? Darcy, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think one of the pieces, like, it's interesting because you keep coming back to safety, and I can see it in your head that you always have the victims sitting in like one of the all wooden ancient courtrooms, and it's going to be a
yeah,
theme.
We got that with a straight back, like. They're like the courtroom gavel goes down, and they're like uncomfortable.
Exactly, and. Fewer than 1% of cases actually getting all the way to a trial.
What percent? What percent? Wait, we missed that. What?
Fewer than 1%.
Wait. Do you mean like of the reported cases or the ones that come to your firm?
No. Of all cases that are brought into suit, less than 1% will go all the way to a trial.
Of all kinds of crime?
No, sexual assault included. But I mean, and the reason being that if you as an attorney are doing a good job, if you are building the case, there is no reason for it to have to go before a jury, because the other side will understand that you can prove this hand down. Mm-hmm. And you've got a very strong case. This is what's happening. And they don't want to go to a trial any more than we do. You know, and those reasons are they're expensive. When it goes before a jury, there is not a black and white piece around either the money piece or what is right or wrong. I mean, leaving it to lay people to make a decision is not necessarily something either side wants. Those laws are there for a reason. Those rules are there for a reason. Your ability to prove the case up front is, I think, really, really powerful. On the one hand, you absolutely want an attorney who has done trials, because that is a very powerful lever to be able to say, if you guys don't talk to us.
Yeah, I'm going to hear about, like, when you said leverage, I want to like help our listeners. I think what you mean is leverage against like the opposition will know I'm willing to go to the mat.
Right. Absolutely. We are willing to take this all the way. We have done this before. We do it very well and we win. Mm-hmm. So knowing that, perhaps you want to stop this process and be reasonable and make reparations for this person to have truly restorative justice where they can, you know, have the money to go live their life. And so settling is interesting because I think that it is can be very healthy for our victims where they don't have to go all the way through the process. And again, we always give them a choice. So by the time you've hired your experts, you've had them talk to people, you have your medical pieces in order, you've already developed all of your evidence, the other side knows what you're going to say. They know that they're going to lose. And they don't want to go there for the
Okay, then Darcy, here's another one. We need to talk about this. Insurance companies paying part of this bill, right? So if you sue, our listeners don't know this. We've never talked about it on the podcast. If this is not your bailiwick, no worries. But since I'm often an expert witness myself, and I've worked for like all the right sides, I know when an insurance company is paying the bill, they have a cap on what they'll pay. So like hypothetically, listeners, like let's say you're suing, it happened at a college. And we could say it happened at a private college or it happened at a state institution. We could also say it happened on a military base or it happened at Walmart. Like we could permutate like the pockets of potential payouts for your damages. And then if it happened in a private home, like an uncle or a boyfriend, we have to go after, like, rolling back to what Darcy said about 20 minutes ago, was we have to take property from a human who owns the property to pay out the settlement. But insurance is really important. We've not talked about, like, how insurance comes into play on paying for some of this damage. And there's caps that most institutions have. And then some say we're not suable. We are the government. You can never sue us. I think that would be a cool way to kind of end where we're headed. And then Darcy, I encourage you to come back for the next one.
There's a piece which is sort of the ugly side of this, which in my mind is the business of law. Right. So there's the criminal part where you would go and you could get justice that way. And then you've got this side, which is the civil side. But it is kind of a follow the money piece. Unfortunately, if you were assaulted by a homeless stranger, there is no money to get there. I can sue them, but they don't have anything. They call it judgment proof. I could take the whole thing to court, come up with a settlement for $1 million, but they don't have $1 million. So we're, a lot of times the civil side ends up looking at things more than just the individual, right? We're concerned about where did this happen? And to your point, are there other pockets? And the pockets, it's not just about the money. It's about who else made some errors to allow this to happen.
And Darcy, can I just, like, this is how I teach this a lot when I go around the world. Just so our listeners can think about it. Like, let's imagine any of you listening to the podcast. Some of you are college students. So let's imagine that you're walking across the parking lot to get to your car on ABC University and the light's out. And it's been out for like months and people have complained about this light out in this high hedge. And there's this like unsafe area where a lot of crime has been reported. So the university had notice. They knew they should have fixed the light. Maybe they should have had security watching it. And maybe they should have trimmed the hedges. And guess what? Oh my God, someone came into the parking lot and nabbed you and raped you and assaulted you. The university and the perpetrator are both at fault. And depending on the university, if it's a state institution versus a private institution, the type of insurance and the pockets and the oversight is going to be different. And then let's permute a little bit more. Let's say you work and are U.S. Army and you're going to your military base for your work every morning. And the same exact thing happens. The government is supposed to protect you. And the government should have fixed the light bulb. And the government should have made sure that someone didn't come on base. That's a different set of circumstances and a different set of insurances. So. And then we can say the last case is I'm going out with my friends to TGI Fridays. It's going to be so much fun. And I'm parked my car in this lot or on the city streets. And I go to eat with my friends and I come back out and I'm raped right by the parking meter in the city streets where I just parked. That's a different, like, should the city have had more lighting? So all of those, listeners, are different sets of circumstances that, like, that's what I was trying to end on tonight a little bit is how does that look? Because what Darcy is awesome at, if you have not heard that from our amazing guest, Darcy's so good, even has a therapy dog. Hello. You can't go wrong with Darcy. And I think her firm has a ton to offer. It's small. It's like the ideal circumstance. And if a she pronoun resonates with you, hello, Darcy. And we're going to get to the love story in 1 second. But where I wanted to just paint pictures for a second for our listeners, like on all the scenarios I just rattled off, they all mean different things when you meet Darcy. When by the time you meet Darcy, whether any of those resonate with you, what she can offer you and her firm can will be different based on, and the saddest thing is notice I didn't describe anything different in any of those scenarios except location. I did not describe anything different in any scenario except where it happened. And so, unfortunately, all my loves listening to the podcast, the saddest part I have to offer for you is your harm and ongoing trauma and getting the hell out of your head and heart and physical body from what happened to you from all of those scenarios will be the same, almost the same, because I said it was always someone you didn't know. I said it was someone you didn't know. It's not like known offender. All of it was stranger. And so the unfortunate part is when you come to meet Darcy, Darcy's only going to be able to offer you something based on the insurance and the location. And it will not ever equate to what the impact was. So please, 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 at the end of this podcast, know that whatever dollar is paid to you or given to you or you acquire doesn't mean you're less or more. It means it still happened and you stood up for yourself and you said, this is wrong. And I want to try to have justice so it doesn't happen to anyone else. But this is the US of A, and all of those jurisdictions mean different monetary values for what you can personally acquire, but it does not change what you can state to the world that should be different going forward. And that is priceless because that means 100 more survivors, if that light bulb was fixed, and those hedges are trimmed, and there's more oversight, that will change everything for everyone else going forward. So I hope that makes sense to our survivors and our listeners. But I'm taking a few words out of your mouth, Darcy, but I wanted to make that really clear in a like visual way.
Great example. So for instance, here in Rhode Island, there is a $100,000 cap if you have a personal injury happen in a public school. Say you were at a public school and they make a horrible mistake in hiring that they should have known about, and you are sexually assaulted by an employee, you're capped at $100,000 by state legislation. Yeah, so those, yeah, that's very frustrating, right? And you may have medical bills that exceed that.
Right. That's what I was trying to say to our listeners. Like, you have to go into all of this knowing, like, people like Darcy are going to be probably a major part of your healing journey. Then the money's good, but you know what's great? Is like, I won. I'm going to simply say, like, knowing I won, I proved my point, and getting someone to change things that are broken is priceless. And that's how I've lived my life. I mean, for our listeners who've read my bio, starting at 18, you fix what's broken. I never sued anybody, even my perpetrator who was worth millions, because I didn't care about his millions. I cared about fixing what was broken. So I kind of land on that. But we not yet to your love story, Darcy, but we're almost there. Emily, anything else? Can you clarify? Because you know our listeners so well. What else might they want to know from tonight?
I don't think that there's anything else. I'm just very excited to hear this love story.
You're right. Land on love. Go, Darcy.
Yeah, no. So, yeah, the attorney here is quite extraordinary, and I liked him so much, I married him. So his story was that he actually started in his first internship out of law school was with the Sexual Victims Unit over in New York, just like the actual thing that we talk about in on TV, and then had a number of cases specifically with the Catholic Church. And he had already had two children by the time that he became an attorney. And so they actually gave him pedophiles as his first job out of law school, which is a really rough place to begin. But he's always been on the right side of the fight and has always had this peace around the sexual assault piece. We have tried to temper a little bit the number of cases that we take because it is highly emotional for all of us. But when I met him and was brought into the case again on the corporate side, I remember hearing him defend this woman in a deposition, and I really thought that the other side was asking some inappropriate questions, and he just did this very masterful job at supporting his person and calling for breaks. And while some of those questions were really difficult, really handholding, I mean, literal handholding, you know, while she was dealing with this. The other piece of our practice, which I think is makes us very unique, is that we have custody of James's brother, David. David is 55 years old and he has Down syndrome. He lives with us. And the number of sexual assaults in that population, I don't know that they get a lot of audience. So I did want to kind of share that with you.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
It's 7 times the rate of people who are not disabled. And it's estimated that for people who are disabled, 83% of women have some kind of sexual assault. And yeah, it's huge. And 30% of men. And yet they only represent about 3% of all sexual assault cases. They are grossly underreported. A lot of times you have issues around the inability to vocalize what happened to you. You know, I think of, you know, our own special person, and there's maybe an average IQ or really a maturity of around the age of 6. So trying to get them to either understand what happened to them or be able to express that in any meaningful way is very challenging if you're looking at a formal court process or bringing those cases to justice. But there are methods that you can do to make those work. So I always want to leave people out there with the idea that, you know, if you have a special person in your life and something you notice that their behavior is off, or they're in a group home or institution and you feel like something is going really badly with their care, you should know that there are avenues and things that you can do to advocate for them here on the civil side, you know, and basically get an attorney to help with that process.
Thanks. Oh my gosh, Darcy, broke my heart just now. Like, made my heart sing when you met your husband and then made my heart break with those numbers. I'm not at all.
I encourage women to shop for the right attorney. And the things that I would look for is kind of the compassionate care. You can ask them some of the questions that we've asked here today about, you know, what does the process look like? How do you support me through that process? Have you ever done a trial? What is your experience with sexual assault victims? You know, how many people go all the way to a trial? What is your average, you know, what does the average award look like? And realistically, the attorney should not be giving you a number because they don't know it. The first meetings, they don't know the details of your case. They shouldn't be leading you or really, I mean, it always feels disingenuous to me. If they're promising you $1 million to come be their client, you know, that's not really an appropriate conversation. They need to come in. You're going to learn about the process. You get to control it, find out whether or not you want to move forward. So for instance, Katie, for you, you know, going forward and being kind of a voice of a victim has been wonderfully empowering for you. There are other people, for instance, like say something bad happened in a public school setting, they might look at $100,000 and go, no, like the whole process isn't worth it to me to move forward. And I guess I just want to make sure that people know they should be working with attorneys that honor that and them. Like you get to say no to the process too. You don't have to continue forward and work with people you don't like. You can always get another attorney. You can fire your attorneys. Well, this is your process to own. And, you know, we are here to facilitate education and, you know, your path on healing. And I encourage women to make that their own path. If this is important to you and that level of justice is good for you, great. We are happy to be passionate advocates for you. But if you learn about it and you say, no, I this isn't for me, I want to step back, then you certainly are able to do that as well.
Darcy, that's so well said. And I just want to restate what you just said for our listeners. What Darcy is telling you is extraordinary. It means like her firm is unique of a lot of firms. She is not in it for the money. She's in it to make sure, first and foremost, that you get the help and support that you need. And she's going to sit there every single step of the way and explain it, help you with therapy dogs. Like, this is the ideal circumstance. But guess what, listeners? There are firms like Darcelyn Hall's firm in Rhode Island. It's unique. It's amazing. And Darcy is part of our legal support team for Take Back the Night. And we are really circumspect. We're like scrutinous of how any of our team members come to be a part of our overall effort to support survivors. And the whole time we've been talking, I hope our listeners will hear that Darslin never once said, we'll turn you down. Every time she said, we'll listen to you, we'll educate you. I love that word. Darcy even said, like, we're here to educate you. We're here to think with you. We're here to support you. And in simple terms, like, Darcy gave you a ton of questions you should ask for any firm. But I'll dare say one cool thing is, even if you live in California or Nevada or Montana, Darcy in Rhode Island is still willing to take your call. I'm speaking for you, Darcy, but like, I feel like you have a whole network. So you'd be willing to talk to anybody, whether they live in Montana, right?
Yeah, I'm happy to have that call. I mean, we want people to, we legally serve Rhode Island and Connecticut. As a woman, I'm happy to take that call all day long. But we legally serve both Rhode Island and Connecticut. You most likely want a lawyer who is specific to your area, because there are those pieces around individual states. For instance, a cap at $100,000 specific to Rhode Island pieces. So you want somebody who's local and knows is an expert in the law in which the state in which you live. But yeah, we're always happy to have a conversation with people.
Thanks, Darcy. I have one last question. So anyway, we'll put in the notes from our episode, obviously, all the ways we can help you at Take Back the Night to find the right fit. Emily, I just want to land on one more happy story I'm going to elicit from Darcy about her husband, because I think that's the joy of it all. Like, when you find a partner who gets, I have a question specific, but Emily, I'm going to land on you first. Like, what else do you want to talk about tonight?
I want to think about a little bit about taking care of ourselves and each other in this process, because it's hard. It's all very hard. And I guess, Darcy, do you have any thoughts on like how we can make sure that we're honoring ourselves and we're honoring each other when we're going through all of these processes, the healing, the legal action, if we choose to pursue it? Like, how do we, I don't know, show our love for ourselves and love for each other?
Well, I think for us personally as a law firm, we obviously take what we do very personally. These are highly emotional for us. I have nightmares about these. I get into these files and I live this with these women. We watch videos and we get medical reports and all those pieces. What works for us is compartmentalizing it and saying, okay, this is what we're going to do here. But I recognize that there is joy in the world beyond this event. So it can be something simple like Luna, the therapy dog, coming and putting her head on your knee while you're talking. That your real life is out there. It is not about the story you're telling. It is not what defines you. You know, it is something that happened to you, but it can, and it may change the course of your life a bit, but it's not always even necessarily a course that's a bad one. It may find you empowered, like Katie, to do something, really wonderful in the world and be able to help other women. It will always be part and parcel of who you are, but it's just part of fabric of the tapestry of your life. For us, we try and find things that are completely not law related. One of our current passions, we are both U.S. Coast Guard captains, and we actually run Sunset Charters here out of Rhode Island. So we will leave here during the day and we will meet wonderful tourists and guests and take them on a great little sunset charter and, try and breathe the fresh air and ground ourselves in nature and, remember the why that we do this. It's, it's for our clients, but it's also so you can have love and appreciate love.
Oh my gosh. That was the same question I was going to ask Darcy. That was like, where do you find love? So you've answered me and both of us at the same time. So Emily and I got our answer. That was beautiful. What an amazing interview. For our listeners, again, wow, another episode of Dear Katie podcast, but such a wealth of knowledge, inspiration. I think listen to it over and over again if you need to go back and hear how that process works. Like, even like, what's a deposition? What's a criminal? What's a civil? Like, we talked about a lot of terms tonight. And please don't even be shy about it. Like, that's a lot of foreign language for lots of people. So just go back. And I think what you'll find when you hear the three of us talk, you're going to find confidence. You're going to find that we are going to sit with you no matter what. And we're not going to be blaming you for any question. There's no wrong question when you're seeking healing and justice. And that's what this episode definitely was about. There's no wrong question. There's nowhere that you can't start. My goodness. So listeners, keep going with us. Tune into another episode of Dear Katie. Emily, do you want to say anything else to close this out before we turn it to Darcy?
I just want to thank everybody for listening. And of course, as we've discussed today, show love for yourself, show love for each other. We're all in this together. And there is so much light and joy in the world, despite how dark it seems sometimes. So make sure you find that light.
Many thanks, Emily. And Darcy, anything you want to say to our listeners?
Well, thank you very much for having me today and for any of our clients that are out there listening in either Connecticut or Rhode Island or Hawaii. We just want to thank you.
Thanks so much, Darcy. And again, to our listeners, please keep tuning in to Dear Katie. We'll release another way to heal and journey together. You're never alone. I'm listening to my own like go to sleep podcast. And I love the part where they say, like, you're not alone. A lot of people are awake all night long. And so I would add to this, you're never alone. All of us are trying to figure out how to heal and how to help. So thank you so much and continue to join us and share our podcast with any friend, family member who you think might benefit. Thank you and take care.